Well, when you think of pro-life, you often think of Christian organizations leading the way. I'm about to talk to an Orthodox Jew stirring up Jewish people in the pro-life battle.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yes, it is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on the Line of Fire. Michael Brown, blessed and delighted to be with you today. We've got a great guest we're going to be speaking with in a moment, an Orthodox Jewish man who is active in the pro-life movement. I'll be taking your Jewish-related calls. It is Holocaust Remembrance Day, the 70th anniversary of the end of the Holocaust, at which time anti-Semitism continues to rise and even explode around the world. So a lot to talk about today. If you have a Jewish-related question relating to Israel, question relating to Hebrew language, Hebrew Bible, Jewish tradition, number to call 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Be sure to check my website for some of the latest articles. Wrote one last night, posted it last night, called Could Biblical Preaching Be Outlawed? Could Biblical Preaching Be Outlawed? And that's an important read for you, all right? So go to the website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org, and you can weigh in the comments section there. Just click on Latest Articles to go to the article. Again, Jewish-related calls, 866-34-TRUTH. So what do we make of the fact that on this Holocaust Memorial Day, this Holocaust Remembrance Day, 70th anniversary of the end of the Holocaust, anti-Semitism is off the charts around the world. Jews in Europe, Jews in England wondering if they can stay there. Jews in France wondering if they could stay there. Anti-Semitic attacks, murders of Jews in Europe. We're not just talking about in the Middle East, in Israel, where there's some suicide bombing or something like that. We're talking about in Europe. We're talking about anti-Semitic acts on the rise. We're talking about lack of safety for Jews, many Jews being afraid to even walk the streets with a yarmulke on, a Jewish man identifying as a religious Jewish man. Fact of the matter is, it's a spiritual battle, friends. Fact of the matter is, there is going to be turmoil until Jesus returns. There is going to be Jew hatred, not based on truth, but based on lies, based on exaggerations, based on demonizing of a people, dehumanizing of a people. And when you dehumanize, these are the things you can expect. In fact, Matt, let's go to Joey, let's go to clip number 10. This is Bruce Ratner, chairman of the Museum of Jewish Heritage in Battery Park, talking about these very issues of dehumanization. Clip number 10.
It is like a disease. It just doesn't seem to go away. There was a period, I would say, in the 70s, 80s, where really, I thought, 90s even, where I thought pretty much it had been put to bed. But it's pretty clear now that it's not put to bed, that you have serious issues of anti-Semitism in England, you have serious issues of anti-Semitism in France, really throughout all of Europe.
Yes, and is it a surprise? No. I'm surprised that Bruce Ratner, as chairman of the Museum of Jewish Heritage, I'm surprised that he would actually think that things may have leveled out and you might have had pockets of anti-Semitism, but not this worldwide phenomenon. And yet we see it again. It is ultimately a spiritual battle, and Christians must lead the way in overcoming evil with good, even right here. All right, we'll be right back with a special Orthodox Jewish guest. Stay tuned.
God of light, hear our cry, send the fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to the Line of Fire on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast, 866-34-TRUTH. Michael Brown, delighted to be with you. I was at National Religious Broadcasters Conference, when is it, the end of February, and on my way into a meeting, and there was went on an elevator to get up to this room, and a gentleman was coming off the elevator and looked like an Orthodox Jew. Now, the reason I say looked like an Orthodox Jew is you don't have that many Orthodox Jews at National Religious Broadcasters. It's overwhelmingly Christian. But you do have sometimes Jewish leaders that are involved with tour groups or various Israel-related initiatives. And he did not look like a Christian wannabe Jew. In other words, he looked like a genuine religious Jew. So as he got off the elevator, I said to him, Shalom Aleichem. If he's a religious Jew, he would know that the proper response is Aleichem Shalom. That's how he responded, got off the elevator. Well, I ran into him later and found out that he's involved in very, very significant work. And it's my delight to bring him onto the broadcast. Lyle Nirenberg, Columbia University School of Law, graduated with high honors. After completing several years of religious study, Lyle has conducted Jewish outreach to groups large and small in person as well as the internet. He served as the chief counsel to an essential subcommittee to the Judiciary Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives, where he advised and counseled members of Congress and worked on such matters as drafting bills, amendments, committee reports, dealt with issues like violence against pro-life organizations, and he is now leading the way in a Jewish pro-life movement. Lyle, it's a delight to have you on the broadcast.
Hi, this is Lyle.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, absolutely, Dr. Brown.
Great, great to talk to you. You know, Lyle, as this is Holocaust Remembrance Day, 7 years after the end of the Holocaust, I'm reminded that both of us would have been killed by the Nazis. You as a religious Jew, me as a Messianic Jew, we would have been killed just the same. And the same way, what you're involved with, Jewish pro-life movement, you're looking to save Jewish lives that are going to grow up in every background, every setting, because every life is precious. How did you, as a religious Jew, get involved in something that most people associate with Christian work?
Do you hear me okay, Dr. Burr?
Yes, I can. Yes.
Okay, so basically on my work as counsel for the House of Representatives, again, I worked on violence against pro-life organizations, and it really opened my heart and my soul to this battle, and I decided years later to tackle this important issue, and this is really important given our shared values. You know, we have very, very many shared values, but and this is we can stress this, rather than stress the difference, we can stress the similarities.
Absolutely.
Christians. And as you know, I'm a son of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And unfortunately, Dr. Brown, Jewish pro-life has been essentially ignored by traditional pro-life organizations for decades here in the state. So I tried to get active against this. And it is very interesting that this is basically a solid Holocaust that we're talking about. And again, today was Holocaust Remembrance Day in Israel. And there's so many millions of Jewish babies, so important, who have been aborted in the state. And that's why I decided to get proactive to educate my Jewish brothers and sisters in the states who are walking in darkness, have no idea of the importance of a Jewish soul, have no idea that there are alternatives, and to educate them, to persuade them gently without coercion, and to open up a dialogue. And that's why I got that's a little bit of a basis of what we're talking about. And again, and to stress our common interests and challenges with pro-life, with Jews and Christians. We have common interests and challenges, and we cannot make the mistakes of the past. Failure is not an option here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm on the air.
All right, Lyle, when it comes to traditional Jewish views of abortion, traditional Jews would be more pro-life than secular Jews, and yet they're not really involved in a serious way in a pro-life movement. I don't know if they think it's not as big an issue in their community. But why is it that secular Jews, liberal Jews in America tend to be on the other side of this, tend to be not just neutral, but often strongly pro-abortion? Why do you think that is?
Well, basically, Dr. Brown, what we have here is they're unaware of their roots. And again, the blessings and the prosperity in America is due to "In God We Trust," as it does in the currency. And a lot of my liberal Jews have forgotten about their links to God Almighty. And they make these, they're very liberal, and they unfortunately are not aware of alternatives. And a lot of people, again, when I was in law school at Columbia, I knew people, and as I do of today, that are making abortions, God forbid, because of career and convenience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're talking about now. And as you probably know, I've used up almost all my savings as a lawyer trying to push this, and I'm really looking for the listeners here to help me. I need financial assistance, a financial basis, experts in social media to really push this forward. And because we got to work together, Jews and Christians, to push back this darkness.
Now, Lyle, there's a well-known Talmudic saying that if you save one soul, it's as if you save the entire world. In Genesis, the fourth chapter, where Cain kills Abel, the Hebrew for the word blood there is plural, as you know, of course. On the one hand, that could just refer to lots of blood, shedding of blood. But Jewish tradition has taken it to mean that it was his blood, and then metaphorically speaking of all of his offspring, that when you killed Abel, you killed all the children he would have had. So it really enhances the importance of a Jewish life, of a Jewish soul. Are you gaining any momentum? Are Jewish people waking up to this reality? Or are they oblivious to this Holocaust of the unborn that's taking place?
Well, they're pretty oblivious, and I'm making, brick by brick trying to do this. But and I really need assistance to get this out to more Jews and to stop this, what we call silent Holocaust. And of course, the millions of Jewish babies that have been so sacrificed due to ignorance and, again, out of convenience and career, really take a bite out of prosperity in the United States and our common belief in God.
Lyle, if someone wants to help, maybe there's a social media expert or someone that's really good with graphics that would like to help you out and get involved. Maybe a Christian serving the Jewish community in this regard. What's the best way for them to do that?
They can call me on my number at 617-249-3370. And I'm more than willing to speak with anybody who wants to lend a helping hand here on this very important mission with our shared values.
All right. Tell you what, we normally don't give out numbers like that on the phone just to make to keep people protected, but why don't you give out that number once more, and I'll let others know through other means. So if you are able to help, you have a burden for pro-life, and here's a way to work with a religious Jewish man, the goal is not that you are secretly trying to infiltrate his work to preach Christianity. The goal is that you are serving a Jewish man to help save Jewish lives and awaken the Jewish community to pro-life. So again, maybe your graphic artist, maybe your internet savvy, social media savvy. Let's just get that number again. 617. Go ahead.
249. 3370.
3370. Yeah, go ahead.
Again, 617-249-3370. And again, I've been out there with speaking to large groups. speaking to lawyers and Jewish lawyers, doctors, talking to in certain educational institutions, trying to get a lot on social media. So we definitely need the assistance, and we've got to open the hearts of these Jewish people, my Jewish brothers and sisters. So any assistance would be greatly appreciated to help us save these precious Jewish lives.
All right, awesome. Listen, we're going to get that information out. You may get some calls that are not viable, but we're going to get this out in a couple of different ways, Lyle, to let folks know about the importance of this. It's rare to do what you're doing. It's sacred in God's sight. It's of great importance, and we're standing with you. Hey, thanks for letting our listeners know about the important work that you are doing. We'll support it however we can. All right, friends, when we come back, take your Jewish-related calls. A whole lot more to come.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Do you have Jewish-related questions? Well, we'll do our best to provide you with Jewish-related answers on The Line of Fire. That means questions about Judaism, Jewish tradition, questions about the Hebrew Scriptures, Hebrew language, questions about Israel today, even America's relationship with Israel. 866-34-TRUTH. President Obama met with Jewish leaders, Jewish groups this week to urge them to back his Iran deal. Now, I appreciate the fact that the president has taken time to do this. I appreciate the fact that he realizes how important relationships with the Jewish community are. Now, does he recognize that simply pragmatically, that Jews are influential in the Democratic Party, and therefore he doesn't want to alienate them from the voter base? Is it beyond that? Is it also that he cares about solidarity with Israel? God knows. God knows. But I'm glad that he did meet. And according to a report by Jordan Fabian, President Obama pleaded with Jewish groups to back his nuclear framework deal with Iran during a private meeting at the White House on Monday. The president held separate meetings on Monday with leaders of major Jewish organizations and a group mostly comprised of Jewish Democratic supporters and donors. He made, quote, an emphatic and passionate case during the nearly 90-minute meeting with Jewish organizations that the deal is the best way to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon, according to an official from a group that participated. There were back-and-forth discussions as well. And, of course, you're aware that President Obama has criticized Prime Minister Netanyahu and said, well, you haven't given me a better approach. You haven't given me a better solution than what we're offering. So what's the good of your criticizing our plan? Well, of course, the answer would be that you have to take military action, that you have strict sanctions against them. And if they go on with their nuclear activity, you have to take military action against them. Israel continues to mull a preemptive strike. According to Intelligence Minister Yuval Steinitz, he said to Israel Radio early this month, if we have no choice, we have no choice. The military option is on the table. He also noted that Israel did not seek American approval before bombing Iraq's nuclear reactor in 1981. And days earlier, General Mohammad Reza Naqdi, a senior figure in Iran's Revolutionary Guard, reaffirmed that Israel remained his nation's primary target. Quote, erasing Israel off the map is non-negotiable, according to this influential Iranian Islamic leader. This is what he was reported to have said, even as our president's team was preparing to sign a deal with the Islamic Republic. So, hey, there are other alternatives. They're just not acceptable at this point to our administration. Pray for wisdom and for God's best plan. 866-34-TRUTH. We'll go to Cambridge, Maryland. Eileen, welcome to The Line of Fire.
Thank you very much. You know, Dr. Brown, I have listened to you many, many times, but over here in Cambridge, I Have not. I just don't get good reception. Well, but I was listening today, and I can call in and ask you a question. So I wanted to ask you about the Seder. And as a follower of Jesus Christ, born again, 19 years, I wanted to say more, but I was delighted and to sit down at the table with my friends, and I just felt if they asked me a question, I would say something, but I wasn't asked a question, so I was just wondering, were they expecting me to say something, or because they do know that I believe Jesus Christ is Yahshua HaMashiach.
Yeah, you know? So Eileen, if you were invited to a Seder, which is the traditional Jewish meal on the Passover, they wouldn't. If you were invited, you're their guest, and they expect you to sit there and enjoy the meal and learn from the traditions. And if you had a question to ask, but otherwise, they graciously invited you to be there. That's fine.
Right. Right.
So no, it's not that there's a custom where if you're there, not as a traditional Jew, that you're expected to ask a question or they're expected to ask you a question. No, there is the Seder. You follow what's called the Haggadah or the Haggadah, which takes you through the various prayers, which takes you through
It's so beautiful. It was so wonderful. I was so blessed the entire evening.
Yeah, so there's a lot of great stuff in it, a lot of great tradition, a lot that's really eye-opening. And then it does tie in, of course, with Israel's history. And there are elements to it that Jewish believers say, hey, some of these elements really point to Yeshua. And by the way, just a pronunciation issue. Some people say Yahshua. There's no such person. That's a mispronunciation. His Hebrew name would have been Yeshua, not Yahshua, but Yeshua. Hey, Eileen, thank you for calling. Remember, you can always listen to every broadcast 2 full hours online. So just go to Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. All right? And when you go there, just during the show, your time would be 2 to 4 in the afternoon. Just click on the banner that says Listen Live. Hey, thank you for calling. Joey, grab for me clip number 12. This is part of my interview yesterday with Jonathan Kahn, author of Mystery of the Shemitah, and now part of the very exciting new DVD on the Mystery of the Shemitah. Let's listen to this excerpt from yesterday's interview, clip number 12.
The Mystery of the Shemitah spans really all of from ancient history to today to modern times. So they're actually going to see really everything. So there's some things that come out visually that way that are kind of stunning than, you know, when you just read it. The other thing is that there's about an hour of bonus material where answering questions about end time prophecy, about preparing, about, you know, all the most often asked questions. So it's about 2 hours, and it's a very, you know, I'm in it, of course, but I didn't do it. They did a real stunning thing. It's just very, very powerful.
Yeah. In point of fact, the DVD really is powerful. Now, look, it is a totally legitimate question to say, all right, Israel had this 7-year cycle, the 7th year debts were released, and then the land would lie fallow. It would be a Sabbath for the land. And then every 7 sevens in the 50th year, it would be a time of not just a financial release, but indentured land returning to those that had owned it, and on and on. Other things would happen in the 50th year, in the year of Jubilee. You could say, all right, fine, there was a biblical calendar, there was a cycle, but what in the world does this have to do with finances today? What? No, I mean, I just don't get the connection, and I think Jonathan Kahn is completely taken out of context, and you're foolish even to entertain it. Just look at it from this angle. If, in fact, America, with all of its world influence, has had these major financial collapses and 7-year cycles, and that they've all happened around the same time of the year, and then you tie it back in to the biblical calendar, the very time when these things would be taking place, it would get my attention. And it has gotten my attention to say, okay, what does this mean? Get the DVD, very powerful. 2 hours, including an hour of bonus material, plus the CD of our great interview yesterday. Just $20 postage paid for both. 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Oh, I forgot to play some Jewish lead-in music. We'll do that later in the broadcast. Interesting article on firstlook.org by Glenn Greenwald. Religious fanaticism is a huge factor in America's support for Israel. Religious fanaticism. In other words, people like you and me believing that God has brought the Jewish people back to the land. People like you and me believing that it's important to stand with Israel. Religious fanaticism. According to the article, a new poll from Bloomberg Politics contains a finding that, if you really think about it, is quite remarkable. Almost half of all Americans want to support Israel, even if its interests diverge from the interests of their own country. Only a minority of Americans, 47%, say their country should pursue their own interest over supporting Israel's when the two choices collide. It's the ultimate violation of George Washington's 1796 farewell address warning that nothing is more essential than the permanent, inveterate antipathies against particular nations and passionate attachments for others should be excluded. The nation which indulges towards another habitual hatred or a habitual fondness is in some degree a slave. Perhaps, George Washington was not thinking then about the Jewish people. I would say that was not in his mind. There was not a Jewish nation for him to be thinking about. But perhaps many Christians believe that God will bless America if America blesses Israel. And even if America did something not in its best interest, but in Israel's best interest, that it would ultimately bring blessing, and therefore it would be for America's best interest. Could that be? Or could that be sometimes? Could it be sometimes that you have to do what's right, even if it's not in your best interest? You do it because it's right? 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Washington, D.C. Gab, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, thank you, Dr. Brown. I just had a question. I wondered, is there a consensus among Jews on why they were exiled for 2,000 years? You know, like what the great sin was that God punished them so bad? I mean, I know the 40 years they know, the 70 years in Babylon they know, but is there a consensus of why the 2,000-year exile happened?
A secular Jew would not look at this as having to do with God and exile as much as political forces or human forces or lack of Jewish initiative. But a religious Jew absolutely believes that it's divine exile because of sin. So the Talmud states that the Babylonian exile occurred because of the sins of the people then. So you alluded to that, the 70-year exile in Babylon. There was injustice, there was idolatry, there was immorality. And because of that, the Jewish people were exiled. But now, as the Talmud is being compiled several hundred years into this current exile, it said, okay, in the days of the Second Temple, so this would be up until the time of Jesus, in the days of the Second Temple, the same sins were not being committed. Idolatry was not present the way it had been before. Immorality was not present the way it had been before. And the answer is sinat chinam, which is baseless hatred. That there was baseless hatred among the Jewish people, because of which this longer exile has come. I've actually commented on that, Gabe, in volume one of my series on answering Jewish objections to Jesus. I raised the point, if that's true, and the Talmudic example is fairly minor in terms of what would cause such a long and lasting exile, what kind of baseless hatred could it have been? And what I say is, if, in fact, it was baseless hatred that brought about the current exile, which is still in effect, although modern Israel has been restored, there's still Jews around the world that are not back in the land. I say it has to be because baseless hatred against the Messiah. That's the only logical explanation. There was baseless hatred, but on the highest level, against the Messiah himself, hence this lengthy exile. Great question. Thank you for it, sir.
Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yeah, a little more from this Glenn Greenwald article about American support for Israel. Michael Brown, welcome back to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on the Line of Fire. Glenn Greenwald writes this: it is inconceivable that a substantial portion of Americans would want to support any other foreign country, even where doing so was contrary to U.S. interests. Only Israel commands anything near that level of devoted, self-sacrificing fervor on the part of Americans. So it's certainly worth asking what accounts for this bizarre aspect of American public opinion. The answer, he says, should make everyone quite uncomfortable. It's religious fanaticism. The U.S. media loves to mock adversary nations, especially Muslim ones, for being driven by religious extremism. But that is undeniably a major factor, arguably the most significant one, in explaining fervent support for Israel among the American populace. So for him, Muslim extremism, where you are murdering people in cold blood for your faith, should somehow be compared to Christian standing with Israel. It's extremism, religious extremism. That's how both are viewed. According to the Bloomberg report, religion appears to play an important role in shaping the numbers. Born-again Christians are more likely than overall poll respondents, 58% to 35% to back Israel regardless of U.S. interests. Americans with no religious affiliation were the least likely to feel this way at 26%. The primary reason evangelical Christians in the U.S. are so devoted to Israel is simple. Their religious dogma teaches them that God demands this. God demands this. Mr. Greenwald, first, the fact that 26% of Americans with no religious affiliation still felt that they should stand with Israel, even if it was not in America's best interest, that tells you it's more than, quote, religious fanaticism. That's the first thing. Why, pray tell, do they feel that way? Could it be that they feel it's important for justice issues? Could it be they feel it's important in light of Jewish history and the Holocaust? Could it be for other reasons that they feel Israel should be supported? That's a question that should be explored more deeply. Also, in light of the history of Christian anti-Semitism, could it be that Christians are seeking to show love for the Jewish people because in the past many professing Christians did not? Is that religious fanaticism? And if you can genuinely see, just by the ongoing developments of history, that the Jewish people have been miraculously preserved and miraculously brought back to the land, and you realize that God is doing this, is it religious fanaticism to honor that? What's the difference, sir, between religious fanaticism and good, solid faith? Or is there any such thing as good, solid faith in your eyes? Just wondering. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Rebecca in Queens, New York. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Hello?
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, okay. Good. Calling concerning an object I bought in Israel. I was at a pro-life Israeli conference. There's a group there called Bad Time, and they had a conference in 2010. And while I was there, I bought a object that had a the shield that the priests wear in the temple with the jewels in it for a friend. But the top over the top of that shield, it was something that looked sort of like an umbrella with an eye at the top of it and a lot of Hebrew writing, which I don't know what it is. And I was about to give it away, and something told me maybe I shouldn't. Maybe it might be Kabbalah or something. So I was just wondering if you knew what that was.
Yeah, the specific object... the specific object I'm not exactly familiar with, but the image of the eye is common in Jewish mysticism. Now, Jewish mysticism is not necessarily demonic or witchcraft. Often people just think Kabbalah is all full of that stuff. But there are some superstitions and things like that, and there is the idea of the evil eye and keeping away the evil eye, and sometimes the eye image is used in that regard. What you can do, though, if you like, is you can take a picture of it, if you can get it with the Hebrew, and just send it. I'm not an expert in terms of objects that are sold, you know, in Jewish tradition that people may have in their homes for different reasons. Some I'm familiar with, some I'm not. Someone else might be able to identify it instantly based on your description, but I'm not sufficiently familiar with those kinds of things. But feel free, if you can take a picture that shows what the Hebrew says. But if it has the eye, that's the assumption that it's to combat the evil eye. That would be the most likely thing. And then if you can just send the picture to Dylan, D-Y-L-A-N, Dylan at AskDrBrown.org. That's D-Y-L-A-N, Dylan at AskDrBrown.org. And we can just tell you what the Hebrew says, okay?
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. And, you know, just also want to make sure you heard that there is a pro-life group called Bad
yes.
Time.
Yes, Bad Chaim, exactly, which it means pro-life in Israel. Yes, some of my Messianic Jewish friends in Israel have worked with Bad Chaim over the years. The thing that my guest that was on earlier, the thing that he's trying to do is get religious Jews involved, because this is mainly followers of Jesus who are involved in the pro-life work. Hey, thank you for the call. I do appreciate it. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Lebanon, Connecticut. Alan, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Well, thanks, Dr. Brown. And I thank you as usual. Appreciate it being a return caller here. For you considering this question now. Well said, you said the oldest hatred, according to Wall Street Journal, is anti-Semitism, was a nice article. In Ephesians 6, you said it was the work of unclean spirits, but I'm wondering about this other facet of it, which I told your very nice call screener, 2 Corinthians 10, verses 4 and 5, which, you know, those of goodwill should pray about in verse 4, but verse 5 is casting down imaginations, their arguments, reasonings. You know, it occurred to me, I was watching Schindler's List, and this child with ill will said, "Goodbye, Jews." And then there was an actor who was a regular on Star Trek said, "I don't understand. You know, one moment my neighbors loved me, and the next moment, there we were, they hated me." I think we're all aware of extremist submission, or Islam in Arabic, or, excuse the expression, Hitlerism, but is there more of a religious movement in Europe? Now, I respect Europeans. I got most of my neighbors are ethnically European. But I was just wondering, is there other imaginations, other religious systems that are against us Jewish people in Europe that we should pray about?
Well, Alan, what happens is you're right in identifying this as a supernatural hatred. It's not that Jews have been perfect, but the level of hatred, the longstanding nature of it, how widespread it is, the absurdity of many of the lies indicate to you that there's something supernatural going on. You know, it's almost like that you and your family are all driving in your cars. You've got you, your wife, and your teenage kids, and everybody has a car. You're all driving in different parts of the city, and simultaneously, all of your tires blow out on all of your cars on different roads in different locations, and it's all at the same time. You realize, okay, something's going on here. Something's going on. This is not just a strange thing that happened. It's not like we were driving in procession, one behind the other, down a road filled with nails and glass and potholes. How did it happen? So you can't connect all the different dots in terms of anti-Semitism in history that joins atheists together with professing Christians, together with white supremacists, black supremacists, radical Muslims, and on this common Jew hatred. You find it in a secular or Buddhist country like Japan. You find it in a fanatically Islamic country. You find it in atheist Russia. This common thread of Jew hatred. So we recognize that it is a spiritual battle. So yes, on the one hand, we do our best to refute the lies and speak the truth. But we also remember we have to fight spiritually, because ultimately people will not be listening otherwise. Ultimately, just rational reasoning alone won't solve this. So I say all that to say this, Alan. When it comes to Europe, Europe is becoming increasingly secular. Europe is becoming increasingly non-religious, except where little pockets where the gospel is growing. and where Islam is growing. Otherwise, it's becoming more and more non-religious. But that would mean that you're going to have more of a secular, liberal form of Christianity that still exists in many of the traditions. And that, I believe, could easily go the way of anti-Semitism before, anti-Semitism again, as it has before. Are there specific religious movements that I'm aware of that are rising up with new anti-Semitism? No, except for just, you know, latest weird anti-Jewish cult that's out there. But beyond that, no, it's the same spiritual battle. It's just going to keep rising up in many different ways. Thank you, sir, for the call.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yeah, finally, our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday Middle Eastern Music. Michael Brown, thank you so much for joining us on the Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. All right, follow up to the last call from Alan in Lebanon, Connecticut, regarding anti-Semitism and its irrational nature, its spiritual nature, its satanic nature. A report from today, Ariel Ben Solomon on the Jerusalem Post. Turkish, quote, documentary says Jews have been masterminded for 3,500 years. Turkish professor says that the Jews are destroying the entire world as they search for the ark containing the Ten Commandments. You got to realize, a lot of people watching this documentary will believe it. They'll believe it. And there are others in the Muslim world, even though they don't know Turkish, I'm sure this type of stuff will circulate, and others will say, you see, there's the proof. So the documentary is called Mastermind. It's a new anti-Semitic film being repeatedly broadcast in Turkey and presents Jewish, quote, domination of the world as going back 3,500 years since the days of Moses. Yeah, so let's think. Where was Jewish domination in the world during World War II? Where is the Jewish domination of the world as Jews were scattered around the world in 18th century, and 17th, and 16th, and 15th, and 14th, and 13th? Where was it? And when Jews were under the Romans in the first century, where is Jewish worldwide domination? And when they were under the Greeks in the 2nd century B.C., or under the Persians and Babylonians, part of the 6th century B.C., just wondering out loud. The film, which first aired on March 15th, has also been spread online by media close to the ruling Islamist AK party and seems to have been inspired by a speech by President Erdogan, according to a report by Memory, the Middle East Media Research Institute. The Turkish film begins with pictures of the Star of David, models of the temple in Jerusalem, and an excerpt from Erdogan's December 2014 speech. Quote, I'm emphasizing this, he said. Do not think that these are operations that target me personally. Do not think that these operations are against our government or any political party. And he said this. The mastermind, and this is the narrator of the film now, the mastermind, whose roots go back thousands of years, who rules, burns, destroys, starves the world, creates wars, organizes revolutions and coups, establishes states within states. This intellect is not only Turkey's curse, but the curse of the entire world. Who is this mastermind? The answer is hidden inside truths and facts that can never be called conspiracy theories. The narrator says, the story begins in the very old days, 3,500 years ago, when Moses brought his people out of Egypt to Jerusalem. The only God he had was the Ten Commandments. This was what was placed inside a wooden ark, which was later brought into the Temple of Solomon. This is not myth, but fact. This is what was, and we have to look for the mastermind to Jerusalem, where the sons of Israel live. History professor Ramazan Kurtoglu, a supporter of AKP, says in the film that the Jews are destroying. This is believed. Here you've got a history professor saying this. And this has nothing to do with whether you're educated or not. It has to do whether you drink the Kool-Aid. It has to do whether you believe the lies. That's what it has to do with. The Jews are destroying the entire world as they search for this ark, which he had was the first things American forces did when they entered Baghdad in 2003, collecting ancient artifacts. Did you know that? That when we entered Baghdad, what, 2003, according to this, did you know? The first thing we did was look for ancient artifacts, see if we could find the ark. And that's probably why we went in the first place, according to this ridiculous nonsense. The narrator also says that Judaism is a political philosophy, not a religion. Three historical figures are mentioned as being people that Jews look up to and follow. The first, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, Maimonides, according to the film, thought that the Jews are the masters and all the other people that would be their slaves. The second, Charles Darwin, was a Jew. Did you know that? You say he wasn't a Jew. Correct, he wasn't a Jew, but who cares about facts? This is anti-Semitism. Who cares about truth? This is anti-Semitism. Charles Darwin, quote, was a Jew, a biologist and a scientist who was the architect of the theory of evolution. The third is a German Jew, Leo Strauss, the father of American neoconservatism. An advisor to Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoglu says in the film that Erdogan is bringing these things to the public's attention, urging them to see the big picture. If people believe lies like this, they can believe anything. And if you say, how in the world could a Holocaust ever happen? Well, it's when people believe all types of irrational and crazy lies. Oh, and I get asked about this stuff on a regular basis, and we see these lies being posted on YouTube. I mean, I've in other places on social media, people responding to videos of mine having to do with Israel and the Jewish people. I've got a whole file, page after page after page after page after page after page, where when I spot these comments, I just do a screenshot of them and throw them into a particular file where... I mean, and it ranges from today's Jews are not really Jews at all to they are Jews, but they're children of the devil. Wolves to be dealt with. Gypsy people. I'm just looking at it. Jews are raised to hate Jesus and they are following satanic books and on and on. And wanted to take over the entire world. People actually believe this. And some of them profess to be Christians. As soon as we spot this stuff, we pull it. Where was that other? Who was the guy pronouncing woes on me? No, that was an unrelated one. Ah, yeah, here it is. Posted on YouTube. Brown is a Zionist heretic, leading the church to worship the Jews instead of Christ. I hold to Messianic Jew heresy. He worships the Jews, not Jesus. He's an antichrist. You've actually got insane, idiotic, crazy stuff like this being posted in the name of Jesus. It's sick. It's despicable. And it reminds us of why we must be spiritually vigilant, because people believe all kinds of lies. So friends, now would be a great time to watch a sobering, eye-opening, really gripping DVD on the mystery of the Shemitah and ask the question, are these seven-year cycles in the Bible repeating themselves now with major financial collapses and world events? Is there something God's trying to tell us? Is he trying to get our attention? Jonathan Kahn is shouting yes, and this really well-produced DVD, 1 hour long plus an hour of bonus material, will really get you thinking and studying. When you get it, we're also including the CD of my interview with Jonathan yesterday. To order, go to Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. AskDrBrown.org. Right on the homepage, click on the resource offer there. My bottom line today, it is tragic but true. 70 years after the end of the Holocaust, anti-Semitism is alive and well. For many followers of Jesus, the Torah, the law of Moses, is forbidding. It's foreign. It's different. What can we learn from God's holy law?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
When you read the Hebrew Scriptures, when you read what Christians call the Old Testament, when you read in particular the five books of Moses, what's one of the things that comes jumping off the pages at you? Well, to me, it's the sinfulness of Israel, the sinfulness of my people. It's the great lesson of our failures. It's the great lesson of our repeated sins, of God's justice, of God's long-suffering, of God's mercy. And for me, one of the great realizations is that God is not doing what he's doing because of Israel's goodness, but because of his goodness, and that God is shouting out the message of salvation by grace because of our universal failures throughout the Hebrew Scriptures. We're going to look at the Hebrew Scriptures today. We're going to think about the law of the Lord, the Torah, and we're going to ask how we relate to it today as believers, and speaking generally, just as Christians, as followers of Jesus. I'm not speaking particularly of a Messianic Jew and the Torah, but a Gentile believer, how do you relate to the five books of Moses? We get asked constantly, well, what about the dietary laws? Are Christians obligated to follow them? Certainly not. The New Testament never lays that on Gentile believers. You may choose to. You're absolutely free to choose to. You may feel there's good reason God gave them to Israel, but they're certainly not given in a binding way to Gentiles. The same thing with the biblical calendar. You might find great delight in following the biblical calendar. You might find great meaning in setting apart the Saturday as the Sabbath. You might find great meaning in remembering that the time to celebrate the death and resurrection of Jesus is in the midst of the Passover season. You might find great delight in celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles with a Messianic Jewish congregation in your community. But certainly it's not an obligation that God gave to the entire church. You might say, you know, maybe there's some reason why God didn't want Israel to sow mixed seeds, you know, in a field and to have a certain separation. And, hey, I'm a farmer. Maybe there's a good reason for it. I'm going to do it. You're free to do it, although it's really clear that the primary reason God was doing this was to teach principles of separation and to keep Israel separate from the nations and to remind them day and night in everything they did, from the clothes they wore to the food they ate to the customs they kept to even personal purity issues and cleanliness issues, that they were a separated people. So it's certainly not a binding thing or something that God requires of everyone today. Absolutely not. Of course, I get blasted by some people who say that I'm a heretic because I do not say that every Christian has to follow the law of Moses. Yeah, that's an extremist out there, but I get blasted. And then I get blasted by extremists in the hyper-grace camp that I say there's great value in the law. So I get misunderstood and blasted by both, or I get rightly understood and blasted because of a severe error in their position. But I want to really look at some practical, constructive things we can learn. Everyone can learn from the law, the Torah. I have a whole chapter in my book, Hyper Grace, where I talk about the law of the Lord is good. And I mentioned at the outset of that chapter, one of the foundational truths of the New Testament is that in Jesus, we're not under law, but under grace. And Joseph Prince, Pastor Joseph Prince, said this: the law justified no one and condemned the best of us, but grace saves even the worst of us. Absolutely right. Absolutely true. The question is, what can we learn from the law of God? How can we grow in grace and purity and holiness and devotion by studying the law? If you've got a Jewish-related question, we've got Jewish-related answers. 866-348-7884.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
The Shemitah brings the fall of powers, but also the rise of other powers.
The Shemitah brings the beginning of a new world order and the rise of the two superpowers. But the Shemitah also can mean the fall.
Ah, that is from the new DVD. I'll tell you about that in a moment. Jonathan Kahn, The Mystery of the Shemitah. In fact, in the first hour yesterday, so you wouldn't have heard it in the second hour, I did an interview with Jonathan. Before I share some other things with you, and I just got to read. This is maybe one of the sickest posts I've ever seen in my life. I read it, a dropper at the end of the last hour. I want to read a bit more to talk about the insanity of anti-Semitism and the ugliness of some of the attacks that we get as followers of Jesus, Jewish followers of Jesus, stand with Israel. But let's get clip number 13. This is from my interview with Jonathan Kahn yesterday. When you order the DVD of The Mystery of the Shemitah, you'll get the CD of our interview yesterday as well, over 20 minutes long, and as always with Jonathan, very, very compelling. Clip number 13.
Well, one of the things of the Shemitah is that the first thing it affected was the economic realm and financial realm. On the last day of the Shemitah, called Elul 29, the very last day, which is in autumn, all the debts of the nation were wiped out, all the credit was wiped out. It's a financial nullification. In the last two cycles of the Shemitah, which is 2000 and 2001, 2008, you have the greatest point crashes in world history. They not only take place in the Shemitah year, not only at the end of the cycle when you have that wipeout, but each one happens on the Elul 29, the exact day appointed in the Bible. That's the wipeout day. That is the wiping out of financial accounts. In 2001, it happens caused by 9/11. September 17th is Elul 29. And then the greatest point crash is in 2008. September 29th is on Elul 29 again, the greatest point crash in world history. Each one happens on the same exact Hebrew day, and the day that happens to be appointed to wipe out the financial accounts, and that are, according to the mystery, the Shemitah, the collapses are 7 years apart. Well, the greatest two crashes up to those days are separated by seven biblical Hebrew years, down to the day, down to the hour, the minute, the second. Nothing but the hand of God could do that. I mean, that alone is truly mind-boggling. And those are the last two cycles. So the phenomenon appears to be intensifying.
Now, again, what I encourage you to do is study this out. You say, yeah, because I don't get the connection between the seven-year cycle in the Bible and today. Well, the connection is there seems to be a connection. In other words, you have these seven-year cycles getting our attention and unfolding at similar times of the year, and financial experts wondered why this was and why 7 years, and then you trace it back, you go back, you know, and it's 14 years or 21 or 28, you're like, why this cycle? And you realize it corresponds with a biblical cycle. Is God trying to get our attention? Is God showing his rulership over the world? Is this part of his sovereignty? Serious question. So go to the website when you have a minute, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. And then right on the homepage, you'll see the resource offer. But when you click on it, I talk about the resource, and then you can watch some clips from the DVD before you order. 866-34-TRUTH. All right, I'm going to go to the phones in a moment. But you want to hear something, I mean, really, really sicko. You know, and the scary thing is that this is in the body, that there are people who actually hold to these things. Are you ready? Brown is a Zionist heretic, leading the church to worship the Jews instead of Christ. Don't let Brown fool Jews. Don't let Brown fool you. Jews today are nothing but the Pharisee sect, did everything to prevent the gospel from going forward, killed the Messiah, the apostles, and they stirred up the Gentiles against the followers of Jesus 2,000 years ago, and ever since they have done it. The Jews have done everything to undermine the morality, have been a curse on the earth, and everyone knows it, is leading the church to idolatry of Jew worship. And then about me, he's a heretic and flagrant racist who exalts the Jews. He thinks you're all morons and is teaching so many heresies, I can't keep track of them. Signs and wonders heresy, his dispensation heresy, his Zionist heresy, his Jews are the chosen people heresy, his heresy that the church is not Israel, his Messianic Jewish heresy, he worshiped the Jews, he worships the Jews, not Jesus, he's an antichrist. I mean, this is somebody with some serious issues to write this type of stuff. And how do I feel when I read? I feel for the person because they're at that level of deception. But my heart goes out to him, you know, that the Lord would grant him repentance and bring him back to the truth. And I smile, on the other hand, because it is a reminder to me of the spiritual battles we are fighting. It is a reminder to me that we are fighting demonic forces and that that's why people can be so deceived. And also reminds you to pray because, although this is not some ugly attack in terms of someone actually attacking me, but it reminds you to pray this type of the spiritual junk that's out there. And we are under spiritual attack, and your prayers make a difference. 866-34-TRUTH. We'll go to Fairfax, Virginia. Jay, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown. Listen as you talk, and I was thinking, the Bible says, tell a wise man the truth, and they will thank you. Tell a fool the truth, and they will hate you. And I just, that was my comment to what people are saying about you. But what I really want to call about is, I ran into a real electric Kool-Aid drinker. I was at a grocery store. She was an employee. It was the initials of the store, TJ. So that I'm not giving them a plug. But I was talking to her. She turned out to be Iranian. First, she said Persian. We got talking about things going on in Iran. And I've talked to a lot of Iranian or Persian, whatever, people. And they, you know, most of them hate what's going on in the regime. That's good. And, you know, she's saying we can't stand the rulers. But then she said something just completely off the chart. She throws me a curveball and said, well, yeah, you know, the leaders of Iran, they're really tied in with Israel, and Israel's behind all the things in Iran, the nuclear stuff. And I'm like, what? What? I mean, what Kool-Aid was she? She drank the whole gallon of Kool-Aid. She must have.
Now, listen, the irrational nature of what's believed, people can easily be demonized. And when they are demonized, that's how you have a Holocaust. The Jews become the scapegoats. Something terrible happens in the economy, it's the Jews. And all you need is that where you grew up, Jewish kids were better off than you, and you could believe it. Or that the name of some well-known banker that you knew was Jewish. And it's like, oh, yeah, it's true. Look, there were people in the Middle Ages who believed that the reason that Jewish men wore a head covering was to cover up their horns. They actually believed that. Yeah, and you know, there's the other thing that when the Hebrew talks about karnei or horns of light, which is just, you know, light shining like from the face of Moses, that Michelangelo took it seriously as if, you know, there was little horns of light. But people actually believe that. When the Black Plague decimated Europe and maybe a third of the population died, Jews got blamed for it. And one thing was because of their hygiene practices following the law, because of their hygiene practices, they were less susceptible. They still died. They lost many, many people. But because of their hygiene, they didn't lose as many as other communities. That proves it. That proves that they were really behind it. And they poisoned the wells with a mixture of parts of animals, parts of humans, and elements of the Lord's Supper, and allegedly poisoned the wells and started the Black Plague. People believe that. When the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215, the Catholic Church Fourth Lateran Council decreed officially that the communion elements were literally the body and blood of Jesus, well, now some of these European Christians said, wait a second, that means that Jews can get at Jesus again because that wafer is literally his body. And there were Jewish men, women, and children who were burned at the stake for allegedly kidnapping and torturing a wafer. My producer Matt sent me a note a little while ago that his favorite anti-Semitic lie was when Hezbollah claimed to have captured an Israeli spy bird. A bird had been captured, and they said it's an Israeli spy. So, Jay, all kinds of crazy stuff can be believed. When I have it thrown at me, again, that's a good sign to me that I'm on the side of truth. But let's remember that around the world right now, anti-Semitism for years has been at levels very similar to levels that existed right at the time of the Holocaust and leading up to the Holocaust. And the idea that now at Holocaust Remembrance Day, as this is 70 years after the end of the Holocaust, that at this time that Jews in Europe are wondering, is it going to be safe for us here? We've lived here for years and years, in some cases centuries and centuries, and Jews are saying, we're going to have to get out of England. We're going to have to get out of France. We're going to have to get out of Europe because it's not safe to live here anymore. Who can imagine it? That's the power of these demonic lies, and that's why it's so important for you as followers of Jesus to pray for the Jewish people and stand with the Jewish people. Not that we're perfect, not that we're flawless, not that Israel is guiltless, but because of God's purposes and love and because of Satan's hatred. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
One reason that many Christians have a hard time relating to the Torah is because they immediately think law. That's what they immediately think, law. They don't think in terms of the fuller meaning of the word, which is teaching and instruction. It contains laws, and it is God's authoritative word, but it is not just law, and sometimes we relate to it as if that was the case. Before I go to your calls and before I give some insights from the Torah, let me just share a prayer request from Israel sent out by my friend Ron Cantor, who has joined me on the air a number of times from Israel. He's asking for prayer for someone that we'll just call S, all right? An Israeli believer. He's new to the congregation Tiferet Yeshua in Tel Aviv. Came to faith about 1 year ago. Recently, he was immersed in water. We went to the Jordan River at the very spot where many believe that John immersed Yeshua. S is super excited about sharing his faith. He's unashamed and willing to meet with rabbis and anyone else who wants to challenge him. He's studying books like Michael Brown's Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus to get equipped. What is unique about S is that when he came to faith, he found a Lutheran church in Jaffa. He didn't know about Messianic Judaism. When he found out about us 2 months ago, he was so happy to worship Yeshua in a Jewish-Israeli context. However, this week, an anti-Messianic group of Orthodox Jews showed up at his house with pictures from his immersion. His father was told that he hit not ser, that means he converted to Christianity. In other words, he has betrayed Judaism and turned his back on his people. Of course, that is not true. You have to understand that even though water immersion began with the Jews, it is seen as the ultimate act of betrayal for good reason. At certain times in history, Jews have been forced to be baptized by supposed Christians. Ron Cantor writes, in 1762, the son of a rabbi was taken from him and baptized. 2 centuries ago, the Russian Empire kidnapped Jewish males from the age of 12 for military service. Quote, the number of forced or virtually forced baptisms which resulted probably exceeded all similar cases in other lands throughout history. The result of this ugly and brutal history is that Jews are convinced that being Jewish and believing in Jesus are mutually exclusive. Ron wrote his book, Identity Theft, How Jesus Was Robbed of His Jewishness, to help people understand that when you embrace Yeshua as the Jewish Messiah, you don't stop being Jewish. The disciples didn't. Ron says, I gave S a copy of the book. He's devouring it. Still, his family is confused. His father is planning on coming with him to the congregation this Friday. Can I ask you, so I'm asking all of you, my dear listeners, to pray for S, for his father, and for the rest of his family. Also pray for us as leaders that we were able to equip him for the call on his life and pray that he matures as a believer, both in knowledge and faith. So can I ask you to do that? Pray for S and his father as they are attending the service at Tiferet Yeshua. This is a leading Messianic congregation in Israel, Hebrew-speaking, Spirit-filled. Pray for that. That'll be tomorrow, 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Chris, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown, how are you doing today? God bless your ministry.
Thank you. God bless you.
Yes, what I was going to bring up today is I am a Baptist, and I go to, and what I have realized when you study the Hebrew faith, and the Bible was originally written in Aramaic, and when you start to understand the Hebrew
Hang on. The Old Testament was written in Hebrew, not Aramaic.
Yes. Okay. I'm sorry. The Old Testament was written in Hebrew.
Right.
And so when you start to understand the Jewish faith, and you start to understand, as being a westernized Christian, what God meant by the feast days, you know, the Feast of Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of First Fruits, Pentecost, Trumpets, Atonement, Tabernacle, you see, when you go from the old to the new, that Christ died on Passover, to the month, to the day, and the hour. He was buried on Unleavened Bread to that feast day. He fulfilled that day. He was rose on First Fruits to that day. Pentecost was poured out on the disciples until the month of the day and the hour that it was supposed to. So you have four feast days that were fulfilled perfectly. And then you have three that aren't. So when you start to understand the three that aren't, Trumpets, Atonement, Tabernacles, they're about the second coming. So mm-hmm. when you start to look back, you say, okay, what does God say in Leviticus 23? He says that they are to keep it a holy convocation. What does holy mean in Hebrew? It means dedicated. Convocation is a rehearsal. He was trying to rehearse this over and over so when the Messiah came, when Yeshua came, they would know who he was. And a lot of them missed it. The Sadducees and Pharisees, just like he said, you know, you can look outside and see the and discern the weather, but you can't discern the signs of the times. And that's something important for us Western Christians to realize. It's not about keeping the feast days. It's about knowing about them because we are grafted in, and we are Israel.
Yeah, and Chris, to explain this, obviously Gentile believers don't become Jews. Jewish believers don't become Gentiles. We just like a man doesn't become a woman or a woman doesn't become a man, and the Gentile believers are part of the larger family, so the commonwealth of Israel. But the key thing you've said is that God's laid things out in advance. God's laid things out. He's laid the pattern out. And I fully agree with you. It's not a command on Gentile believers to keep the biblical calendar, to keep every festival, but to recognize and understand the importance of these things, to recognize and understand the importance of God's holy truths. And absolutely, beginning with trumpets, this points to the return of Jesus, and then cleansing and national atonement for Israel with Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement, and then tabernacles signifying the final ingathering of the Gentiles, of the nations. It's laid out in advance. Doesn't mean that we can pick the specific day or hour, but we understand the larger purposes. And Paul wrote to Gentile believers in Corinth, a number of whom would have been familiar with the Jewish calendar because they were God-fearing Gentiles who went to the synagogue to learn about the God of Israel. He writes to them in 1 Corinthians 5, keep the Passover. Now, he seems to mean it metaphorically there, but at the very least, it's telling you that they knew all about it. Exactly right, Chris. Thank you for the call and reminding our listeners of things we've shared many a time here on the broadcast. 866-34-TRUTH. So, you know, that's what I wonder about. I wonder about, from God's perspective on the calendar, does the clock keep ticking? Not that everyone is under the Sinai Covenant. No, we're not. The church is not under the Sinai Covenant. To make that as clear as I can, the church is not under the Sinai Covenant. God has written in our hearts a new and better covenant where the righteous requirements of the law are now written on our hearts. But we're not under the Sinai Covenant. But there is a calendar. There is a time clock. I believe since the beginning of creation, every seventh day was still the Sabbath. Not that God commanded it universally, but that's what existed from the beginning when God sanctified the day. The whole message of the mystery of the Shemitah DVD and book is that the clock is still ticking. The seven-year cycles still have significance, and God is getting our attention to what? That he's the living God. So if you haven't ordered yet, go to AskDrBrown.org, AskDrBrown.org, click on the homepage, and watch the video, give you some excerpts from the DVD, The Mystery of the Shemitah, or you can call 1-800-278-9978, 1-800-278-9978.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Lindsey Graham was on with Hugh Hewitt on his broadcast yesterday. Quote, "The only reason they killed 3,000 of us on 9/11 and not 3 million, you, is that they couldn't get the weapons to do so. And if you let the Iranians go down the nuclear road, I'm afraid they will share that technology with a terrorist organization, and it will be a bad day for America and our allies." According to Washington Examiner, Netanyahu on Wednesday compared Washington's deal with Iran to Europe's appeasement of Adolf Hitler, which led to the Holocaust and World War. Let's remember, we're not just talking about Iran's actions, but as Lindsey Graham said, Iran's participation, active participation with terrorists around the globe. 866-34-TRUTH. You've got Jewish-related questions. We've got Jewish-related answers. Before I get back to the phones, let me just talk to you about the law of the Lord, the Torah, the teaching of the Lord. When the Hebrew Scriptures were translated into Greek and what's called the Septuagint, and by the way, the Hebrew Scriptures have a few little portions in Aramaic, just to be clear, on the heels of the previous call, a few little portions in Aramaic, but otherwise written all in Hebrew. And as I'm finishing my commentary on Job, boy, some of it is difficult Hebrew. Yeah, Job is the most difficult book in terms of the Hebrew and, of course, philosophically in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible. But when the Hebrew Scriptures were translated into Greek in what's called the Septuagint, the Greek word nomos was used to translate Torah. Nomos means law more than Torah means law. And hence we have that sense of it more in the New Testament. It's the law, the law. Now, traditional Jews speaking English will talk about the written law and the oral law. However, they also understand that the law is not just law, but also definitive teaching, instruction. So many times we don't relate to it properly because we don't understand it as divine instruction. Very, very plain and clear that you cannot be justified by the works of the law, that you are justified by grace through faith. It is a gracious work of the Spirit, a gift, and not according to our works. Hypergrace teachers emphasize that as well. I absolutely agree. But laws in and of themselves are not bad. Law in and of itself doesn't kill us. What kills us is commandments being written on stone that we can't keep. What kills us is requirements on the outside of us that we're unable to live up to and that have a death penalty if we fall short. It would be like this. If you have a law that says, if you walk on the ground, you will die, and the only place you have to walk is the ground, that law condemns you. That law brings death. That law brings absolute hopelessness and despair because you have to walk on the ground. You can't walk on the walls or on the ceiling. There's no other place to walk, but if you walk on the ground, you die. So the problem is the nature of that law, not the nature of law itself. It's good that we have speeding laws. It's good that people cannot drive whatever speed they want in every neighborhood on every road. Otherwise, people would be getting killed left and right. That's a good law. It is a good law. Don't murder. It's good we have those laws on the books. And if someone murders, they will be put in jail or even put to death for it. The point is, when God writes his law on our hearts, it's wonderful. It becomes our nature now to follow him. It becomes our nature now to do his will. It becomes our nature to love him and please him. And that's now who we are in Jesus, empowered by God's grace. Law itself can be good or bad or neutral. God's laws are all perfect. What kills us is when they're written on stone, not on our hearts because of our sinful nature. But when they're written on our hearts, it brings life. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
The lessons that came out of the Holocaust, the issues of morality, the issues of values, the issues of dehumanization, the real, I would say, the what is generally agreed, the overall way in which this sort of killing and murder happens is by individuals dehumanizing other individuals, seeing other people not as individuals, but as others, and not seeing them as human beings. And that lesson is applicable to everybody, that when people dehumanize, that is what leads to this sort of tragedy.
That is Bruce Ratner, chairman of the Museum of Jewish Heritage in Battery Park, speaking with specific reference to the Holocaust. Look, you have in church tradition, beginning in the second and third centuries, different Christian leaders who begin to demonize the Jews, and then other Christian leaders who begin to embrace a wholesale theology against the Jewish people. And it opens the door centuries later to all types of horrific persecution of Jewish people. Without a history of quote, Christian anti-Semitism in Europe for centuries and centuries, you could not have had a fertile enough soil for the rise of the anti-Jewish sentiments that took place in the Holocaust. Something contributed to it. In the Islamic world, where Jews are vilified as the sons of monkeys and pigs and are dehumanized in cartoons and in the media, it's easy to just look at them as some type of pariah that needs to be wiped out and destroyed. We must learn the lessons of history 70 years after the end of the Holocaust. 866-34-TRUTH. Welcome back to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Let's go to Chicago. Abraham, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you. I have a question. I know you don't believe in oral Torah, and every time you say in a debate the reason why, when a rabbi quotes it to you, it says in Deuteronomy that you must go to the sages and the judges at the time, you say that's talking about just civil war, not civil, between man and man, not nothing to do with the law. Correct?
Yeah. Now, can I just mention, though, Abraham, that you actually misquoted the passage? That you read your own interpretation into it in Deuteronomy 14, because you said to go to the sages and the judges. Doesn't mention the Chachamim, doesn't mention the sages at all. It's the Levitical priests or the judge who's in office. So you actually changed the text according to Jewish tradition. I'm not sure if you were aware that you did that.
I was not aware, but thank you for letting me know that.
Yeah.
Then every time you so where do you get this from? Aren't you interpreting yourself when you say it's just talking about civil between man and man? That's also interpretation.
Let's take a look and see. By the way, if you've got me on speakerphone, make sure you just put me on regular, because otherwise it's very difficult for folks to hear. But I'll just read here from a Jewish translation. Okay, so look at what it says. Devarim, so Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 8, if a case is too baffling for you to decide, be it a controversy over homicide, civil law, or assault, matters of dispute in your courts, you shall promptly repair to the place that the Lord your God will have chosen and appear before the Levitical priest or the magistrate in charge at the time and present your problem. When they have announced you the verdict in the case, you shall carry out the verdict that is announced to you from that place that the Lord chose. Observing scrupulously all their instructions to you, shall act in accordance with the instructions given you, and the ruling handed down to you must not deviate from the verdict that they announced to you, either to the right or to the left. So,
it's
Devarim, Deuteronomy chapter 17, beginning in verse 8. You'll even see that the rabbinic interpretation, beginning with Rashi, is that rulings about dam or dam, which is bloodshed, homicide, he takes to be questions about a woman's monthly period. So it's even a strange reading there. I have, number one, no problem with the fact that traditions exist, and many traditions in Judaism are beautiful. I don't deny that they exist. I don't deny that some of them are ancient. What I deny, number one, is that that connects to Deuteronomy 17. For example, the fact that that rabbis have told a religious Jew what to say in the morning when you wake up, the prayers to pray, how to wash your hands, how to conduct yourself in every area, you know, wearing a kippah, a head covering, which is, of course, is not mentioned anywhere in Scripture for all Jewish people, that the rabbis now have authority to tell the Jewish people to do all these things to the point that it's almost worse to reject the rabbinic interpretation than the written word of Torah itself. And if I can show you a contradiction between the written Torah and the Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral Torah, that you'll follow the oral Torah. So
yeah, because I don't look at it as a contradiction. I look at it as I'm just explaining it. For example, I know you say a lot, Achrei Rabin Lahatis, you bring that a lot in to show how the Rambam, especially, how he quotes it in the beginning to Pirush HaMishnayos, and says, and you bring that a lot as a proof that the Maimonides is basing it off of above Matzia 59b. He's basing it, he's completely wrong reading, and that means you can't really follow Maimonides. Well, obviously he knows. I don't think that you either think that he didn't know what the pasuk says. I'm positive what the pasuk says. He's explaining it and based off of the Gemara. The Gemara is also. Tom was just explaining it.
All right, so let me ask you a question. If I say, okay, I understand exactly what you said, and what you told me is that you don't believe in the Rambam, you don't believe in Maimonides, and you don't believe in the Talmud, that would be a contradiction of what you said. That would not be an explanation. That would be a contradiction. So when oral tradition contradicts what's written in the Torah, that indicates to me that it's not authoritative. When it, for example, when it takes Deuteronomy 17, and says this now applies to the rabbis having authority over the Jewish community, even telling you what prayers to pray and what time of the day to pray them. No, I say you're usurping authority. God never gave you that right. And it should concern you as a religious Jew that with all the sincerity of the rabbis, they took authority that God didn't give them. So if we look at Exodus 23, for an example, and I just need to explain this for a second, Avraham, for the sake of my listeners that don't understand Hebrew. So here's the question. We know that there can be homiletical interpretations. The New Testament has them as well, where there's a play on words, where the verse says one thing, but you are now using it to make another point. You know, preachers do that commonly. But it's another thing if I'm basing doctrine, basing law, basing practice on a verse, and I'm misinterpreting it. So Exodus 23, verse 2 says, Lo tiyei acharei rabim l'ra'ot. So, and I'll read just from a Jewish translation, the New Jewish Publication Society version. So, Lo tiyei acharei rabim l'ra'ot. You shall neither side with the mighty to do wrong. V'lo taneh arov lintot acharei rabim l'hatot. You shall not give perverse testimony in a dispute so as to pervert in favor of the mighty, or rabim can also be the multitude. So it's saying at the end of this, Acharei Rabim Lahatot. Lahatot means to turn aside. Lahatot min haderek, to turn aside from the way. Lahatot min hamishpat, to turn aside from judgment or justice. So don't follow the majority to pervert justice, is what it's saying. That's quoted in a dispute where God himself speaks on behalf of a rabbi, Rabbi Eliezer, and gives miraculous confirmation that his ruling was correct. And the rabbis don't listen to him. And then ultimately, they say, we have to follow the majority. And they quote the end of this verse, Acharei Rabim Lahatot, which does not mean follow the majority. It means don't follow the majority to pervert justice. So the verse says, don't follow the majority to pervert justice. They say, we have to follow the majority even when God speaks. That to me is terribly dangerous. And then Rambam, Moses Maimonides, in the 12th century, says that's the correct reading of the text, the way it is in the Talmud, even though other interpreters, I'm sure you've read, you know, Ibn Ezra and other interpreters that are just explaining what the Torah means there, and they understand that that's not the right sense of it. So that, can you see that as a problem, sir? And I appreciate, you're obviously a religious Jew, that you've watched these debates and things like that. Can you appreciate that could be a problem when the plain sense of the words is changed and you're going to believe what the rabbis say because they're the rabbis? Can you see that could be dangerous?
You yourself said that even preachers would change certain things. You're saying the difference is because it's law, it's not just a verse?
Yeah, because you're not listening to the voice of God, because the Chachamim, the sages, said no to God's voice and no to miraculous confirmation based on a misinterpretation of the verse. That's the big, big problem.
I don't look at it as a mistranslation of the verse. I look at it that there. I didn't look at the Talmud, that portion in the Talmud so clearly. I just read it like once. I will have to read all the commentators on it, but I don't look at it as they're going against what it's saying. I look at it, they're interpreting what God says.
Yeah, well, the problem, what I'd like you to consider, and by the way, when we've got a break coming up, and I'd love to talk to you again, or especially on a Thursday, I'd love to engage conversation again. I would love to send you a book that I wrote called The Real Kosher Jesus. We won't put your name on any list. Once we send it to you, we'll throw out the mailing address. But if there's an address that we could send it to, it's a free book I'd like to send you. Tell Betsy. She's just going to speak with you now. If you don't want it or we can't send it to you, that's fine. But if we can, I'd love to. So Betsy's going to talk to you. And if we can send it to you, give the address, and then we'll throw the address out after we send it.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, so still got Avraham on the line here. Time is short, but go for it, sir.
I have just one other question. In Isaiah 7:14, do you believe that the word Alma means virgin?
No, it doesn't primarily mean virgin in and of itself. It means a youthful woman, presumably virgin because of her age, but alamut, it has to do with not with virginity specifically, but with youthfulness. For example, David was called an elem. It doesn't mean that he was a virginal male. So alma could well refer to a virgin, but the word in and of itself does not mean virgin. It means maiden, young woman. And understood by the Septuagint, the Greek translation, of Isaiah and of the Hebrew Scriptures, that they translate it with Parthenos, which at that time most likely would have meant virgin. And Matthew explains that this Alma, Miriam, was a virgin. But the word in and of itself, no, does not mean virgin. The word betulah means virgin in legal contexts, and in other contexts can just mean a young woman. So the Scriptures will talk about a bachur, a young man, and a betulah, a young woman. And it doesn't necessarily mean a virgin in a non-legal context. But betulah is used more often for virgin than alma, although alma can refer to a virgin.
And also, in what sign would it be for the King Ahaz when this war was happening, when he was born around 700 years after this whole story?
Oh, yeah, of course, that's a very legitimate question. Unfortunately, I'd love to be able to get books to you because I address these at great length. And if you have an email address, we'll try this just when we get off the phone. If you have an email address, we can send you links where you can watch me address these. But initially, there must have been some type of sign for Ahaz. You see, there are prophecies that were given to the line of David. And if you'll see, because, of course, he is the prototype of the Mashiach, of the Messiah. And there are promises that were given to David that were never fulfilled in his lifetime. Promises that were given to Solomon never fulfilled in his lifetime. Even the promise of the king being born in Isaiah 9, Yelod Yulad Lano Ben Nitan Lano, a child is born to us, a son is given to us. There are prophecies there that could have been made about Hezekiah that were never fulfilled. So all of these promises, we look for them to be fulfilled to the line of David eventually. And you'll notice in Isaiah 7, that even though Ahaz the king is spoken to, that it's Beit David, the house of David, that's being spoken to in the plural. God's going to give them a sign. So it seems that God spoke of some supernatural birth or birth of great importance because he told Ahaz, ask for a sign. I mean, up in the heavens or down, you know, this is the greatest miracle you want. God would do it. And Ahaz, because he apparently wants to lean on the arm of Assyria, doesn't want to trust God, says, no, I don't want to test the Lord. So it seems there's a sign of judgment for Ahaz, something negative of God's intervention, perhaps a promise that there's going to be someone else that's going to rule and reign instead of him. And the child is symbolized by being called Emmanuel. But we don't know anything beyond that. If you'll study Jewish tradition, and ask what's the siman, what's the sign? If you look at Mikraot Gedolot, the rabbinic Bible, and look at all the different interpretations, there are many, many different interpretations. No one can agree on the sign. What I believe Matthew did 700 years later is says something happened in the days of Ahaz, some type of sign, but the fullness of that prophecy, and a child being born supernaturally called Emmanuel, God with us, that hasn't been fulfilled yet. That's a promise to Beit David that hasn't been fulfilled yet, and that's how I understand it. You know, I'll give you one example quickly with the Galut, with the exile, that the prophets Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Isaiah said there's going to be this glorious return from Babylon. And Jews are going to come. There's going to be a way in the wilderness, and we're going to come back from all around the world, and Jerusalem will be this glorious city, and God will move so wonderfully there that our hearts will turn after him, and we'll never leave him again. And even the Goyim, the Gentiles, will turn. Well, what happened? About 44,000 Jews returned from exile, but most of the prophecies about the return from exile never happened. The temple was rebuilt. But the whole Jewish nation didn't turn to God. So we now see still the prophecies being fulfilled. In other words, part of them happened then, and the rest are happening in our day. Same with messianic prophecies. Some of them were fulfilled in the days they were spoken. Some of them hundreds of years later. Some we're still waiting for.
Okay, I have one more question about the ritual slaughtering. It says in Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 21. That
yeah.
Slaughter the meat and the way I have commanded you. Where is that? Where do you? What do you think about that? Where is it that that is the way I've commanded you?
Yeah, if you look at the Hebrew phrase kasher tzviticha, as I have commanded you, in a few verses later there in Deuteronomy 12, if you'll just check every time, you'll find that kasher tzviticha. It's talking about something a few verses earlier. It's talking about something that just happened. So all you have to go back to is Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 15. Whenever you desire, you may slaughter and eat meat in any of your settlements according to the blessing that the Lord your God has granted you. The unclean and the clean alike may partake of it as of the gazelle and the deer. Deuteronomy 12, 15. And then you skip down to verse 29. If the place the Lord your God has chosen for you to establish his name is too far for you, you may slaughter any of the cattle or sheep that the Lord gives you, as I have instructed you. Just explain that a few verses earlier. So that this whole idea that's taken up in the Mishnah and Chulin, that this refers to a command for ritual slaughter and slicing the neck a certain way. No. That's not what the text is talking about. This is Kasher Tzviticha. I just instructed you a few verses earlier. So Deuteronomy 12:21, you find the answer in Deuteronomy 12:15. Hey, Avraham, I'm out of time. I appreciate every one of your questions. I've addressed them at length in writing and on video lecture as well. So if it's impossible to get a book to you or get it to a friend, I understand. That's why I asked. If there's a way for us to get email information to you, we can send you some links and you can watch them. So we'll give it one more try. Betsy's going to check with you. Hey, friends, sorry I couldn't get to more calls. So Betsy, you can. All right, there we go. Thank you. Sorry I couldn't get to more calls. But when I have a traditional Jew like Abraham call in with some great questions, wonderful questions, questions that I had to study and find out the answers to decades ago, it's a wonderful opportunity to interact. And it's one of the foremost reasons that I'm on the air, especially on a thoroughly Jewish Thursday. So let's really pray for Abraham. He's obviously a sincere man, and he's obviously serious, and he's thoughtful. Let's pray that the Holy Spirit would open his eyes and give him the courage to follow Jesus Yeshua as the Messiah. Will you join me in doing that? And friends, stand with us in ministry. We are in a very unique way on the front lines of reaching the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Our materials have been used to bring many Jewish people to faith and help many more stay in the faith. And it's through your faithful support that we're able to do this and put so much free information online and support me to write and research and put these materials out. Why not become a torchbearer? Why not become a monthly supporter? Put aside a dollar a day or more per month and $30 or more per month. Help us as a torchbearer. We'll send you a book as a thank you gift, a new message every month, give you 15% discount in our online bookstore, and access free to our online video and audio classes. So call to stand with us, 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978, or go to askdrbrown.org. My bottom line today, God is regathering the lost sheep of the house of Israel.